From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jay McInerney about his latest novel, The Last of the Savages. Set in the late 60s and 70s, it follows the lives of two men of opposing backgrounds and temperaments. The more extroverted, rebellious character is a white man from Memphis obsessed with black music. He becomes a record producer. Also, we'll hear the story of the Memphis DJ who introduced a generation of white teenagers to black music, Dewey Phillips. He was also the first DJ to play Elvis Presley. Now some of his shows have been preserved on CD. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Sheryl Crow's new CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. United Nations officials are reporting new evidence of atrocities in Croatia. They say 200 bodies have been uncovered from a mass grave, and there's evidence that many of the victims were hospital patients in the city of Vukovar. It's believed they were shot and killed in 1991 when Serb forces captured the area. Tropical storm Josephine never quite made hurricane status, but it did make its presence felt as it hit the Gulf Coast of Florida. Some 400,000 homes in the state are still without electricity. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
Josephine spawned tornadoes, flooded streets, and downed power lines and tree limbs as she hit Florida's swampy western coast. But officials say there are no reported deaths or serious injuries from the storm. Josephine never reached hurricane strength as feared, but lashed the coast with 65-mile-an-hour winds and storm surges 5 to 7 feet higher than normal as she came ashore in Taylor County. The county's emergency management director, Oscar Garner, says it looks like the area was pretty lucky. Rainfall totals of 6 inches or more caused flooding, but early damage assessments reveal little wind damage. The storm is moving rapidly up the East Coast with heavy rains, occasional tornadoes, and wind gusts up to 50 miles an hour. A gale warning is posted from Cape Canaveral, Florida, northward along the eastern seaboard into New England. This is Debbie Elliott reporting.
British police and army experts are trying to determine how anti-British guerrillas managed to sneak explosives onto a high-security military base. The blast there wounded 31 people. A breakaway faction of the Irish Republican Army has claimed responsibility for Monday's attack. A Russian cargo plane carrying luxury cars for the Middle East crashed into a farmhouse in northern Italy today. 3 crew members were killed and 13 passengers injured. 7 people managed to escape the flaming wreckage. Regina Sansaloni reports.
The Antonov 124 cargo plane was attempting to land at the Turin airport during a slashing rain when it was apparently unable to stop before reaching the end of the runway. Observers said the pilot attempted to take off again, but the landing gear of the plane hit the roof of a multifamily building, igniting a fire and causing the aircraft to go down in the village of San Francesco al Campo, located next to the airport. A Turin airport police spokesperson said that 20 persons on board survived, though several are seriously injured. A local government official said the crash of the Russian-made plane destroyed at least 2 residential buildings and cut off telephone services in the village. The flight had originated in Moscow and was known to be transporting Russian goods to Italy. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average moved back above the 6,000 level briefly today, but it's now down a fraction of a point at 5,979 in active trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is down 3.5. This is NPR News. This year's Nobel Prize in Economics has been awarded to William Vickery, a Canadian teaching at Columbia University, and James Merlies of Britain's Cambridge University. They were cited for their research on how information, or the lack of it, can shape business decisions. The two men will share prize money of more than $1 million. The French government today launched an all-out attack against separatists from the island of Corsica. The militant Corsica guerrillas have claimed responsibility for a bomb outside the Bordeaux City Hall over the weekend that failed in an apparent attempt to assassinate French Prime Minister Alain Juppé. From Paris, David Culhane reports.
The so-called historic wing of the Corsican National Liberation Front has generally confined its terrorism to the French-owned island in the Mediterranean Sea. But this move to the mainland has reminded the French government of the major bombing campaign of Algerian terrorists last year. The result, a crackdown that includes widespread arrests of suspects and the deployment of heavily armed riot police around public buildings and monuments in major cities. The government also appears to be signaling the end of secret peace talks in which economic aid was offered, but no independence. The irony is that polls show some 86% of the island's 250,000 people are opposed to full independence. For National Public Radio, this is David Culhane in Paris.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat says Israelis and Palestinians must live together as neighbors and watch out for each other's interests. On his first public visit to Israel, Arafat met today with Israeli President Ezer Weitzman. A California Highway Patrol officer says investigators now believe vandals responsible for the spate of broken windshields on freeways in the state may be tailing victims, then firing a pellet gun or slingshots at the windows. There were 31 new reports of shattered rear windows last night. So far, no one has been injured. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jay McInerney's first novel, Bright Lights, Big City, was about the young people of his generation immersed in the New York nightlife of the 80s. His latest novel, The Last of the Savages, examines the generation that preceded him. The novel opens in 1965 and follows the lives of two young men of opposite backgrounds and temperaments who become best friends at a New England boarding school. Patrick Keene is from a working-class family in New England. His goal is to play by the rules, become a lawyer, and reach the upper levels of the establishment. Will Savage is from a prominent, wealthy family with deep roots in Memphis, and he wants to cut loose. He's white, but obsessed with black music. He becomes a record producer whose excessive appetites make him the subject of legend. Patrick, who is repressed, watches Will and the rest of the counterculture from a distance. I asked Jay McInerney if he understands the character's opposing impulses, one to enter the establishment, the other to subvert it.
I think that there's a way in which I split myself in half with these characters. I certainly identify more with Will, or I initially did. I don't feel that I've led the conventional life. My politics aren't conservative, as Patrick's are. And yet, as I got farther into the book, initially Patrick was almost a device, a narrative device for telling Will's story. But as the book went along, I got more and more interested in him. Patrick is someone who self-consciously admires the outlaw soul of his best friend, but can't follow him down that road.
Both of the characters in this book are reinventing themselves. Patrick, the person from the lower middle class family who wants to become part of the Ivy League and part of the establishment, he's reinventing himself to be a person of pedigree. And Will, who's from the South and from a well-known family there, is reinventing himself as a radical, as a music person. Why is reinvention such a classic theme in American fiction? It seems so many really good novels and so many great classic American novels are about reinvention.
Yeah, I think it's the great American theme. We all came over here to start fresh. You know, we came to this great tabula rasa of a country, or at least that was how we saw it. And certainly as somebody who writes about New York, as someone who loves New York, the whole reason for New York's existence is a stage for people to come and to reinvent themselves.
What personal relevance does that theme of self-reinvention have for you?
Well, I guess I fled from the background that from my own background, I guess that I, like Patrick, I'm Irish Catholic, although I didn't come from, my father was a very successful business executive. Everyone in my family for generations has been in banking or in business. And I was horrified by the idea of following in their footsteps. I was in my callow, youthful way, I felt very superior to my hardworking, accomplished forebears, and I wanted nothing more than to, flee the suburbs, move to the city, become a bohemian, smoke French cigarettes, and write in cafes.
Well, I think you write really well about how if you're trying to reinvent yourself, your parents are a real problem.
Oh, they're all, yeah.
They're evidence of who you were and where
they,
you're from.
Yeah, you can't. they tend to pop up at the wrong times and to kind of compromise your whatever act you may be trying to pull off.
There's a passage I'd like you to read, and this is early on in the book, and it's about the main character Patrick's feelings of embarrassment when his working class or lower middle class parents take him to prep school, and as he says, he's begun to disown them in his heart.
Indeed. I should preface this by saying this is not a description of my own mother, God rest her soul. But I think it's typical of, I guess Patrick would be about 15, 16 at this time. My mother is, shall we say, a noticeable woman. Nearly 6 feet tall, she has a bust like the prow of a ship. The fact that she had always been a doting and devoted mother did not prevent me from feeling, somewhere around the dawn of puberty, acutely embarrassed by her sheer physical volume, bright clothing, and clarion voice, its broad, adenoidal vowels redolent of the tenements of South Boston. She compounded the crime of being the parent of an adolescent by being so damnably conspicuous. My father, as if to compensate, tended to recede. He is, in fact, 2 inches shorter than my mother, and this, too, was a source of chagrin. Fathers were supposed to be taller, and, when visiting their sons' prep schools, were not supposed to wear checked sports jackets worn shiny at the elbows, nor polyester ties. This much even I knew. I was, in short, an ungrateful little twerp.
Did you ever have the sense when you were younger that when your parents were really embarrassing you or giving clues about who you really were before you started becoming the person who you wanted to be, that you were being really ungrateful at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the, if that description and others like it has any force, it comes out of a sense of acute mortification on my part about several incidents. The one that I remember best, I think, is when my parents took me to college. I went to Williams in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and I was not a preppy. Many of the guys at Williams and the women at Williams were from Andover and Exeter and Hotchkiss and so on. And I'd come from a public school, so I was kind of self-conscious about that. And I was a little younger than everybody. I was 17, and I was just dying to start my new life, and I couldn't wait for my old life to begin and my new life to start. And I remember my parents bringing me, and I remember my mother's consternation about essentially losing me, and even though I knew how bad she felt, I just could not wait to get rid of her. Couldn't wait to get her out of the dorm. Didn't want my new friends to see them for some reason, although my parents were incredibly presentable, both very attractive people. And their hearts were to some extent breaking about this radical change in their life, and they're losing their son to the larger world. And I was just, all I could think about was how to get them into the car and get them the hell off the campus. And I remember, as they drove away, turning away and not waving. And I don't know what, I mean, when I look back on that, I still cringe. I'm blushing right now.
Let me ask you to read the very first sentence of your novel, The Last of the Savages.
Well, it is kind of pertinent. I think I can do from, I don't have to find it. The capacity for friendship is God's way of apologizing for our families.
Now, how'd you come up with that, and why did you lead the book with it?
Well, the book really is about friendship. And as you've already pointed out, the primary motive of Patrick Keane and Will Savage, I guess, is an attempt to flee their backgrounds, their families, an attempt to reinvent themselves. And I guess just because I think it's true. it certainly seems to resonate with a lot of people. But I think I think that's the old cliche that you can't choose your family. That's what makes friendship so interesting, I think, as a subject. Here's our attempt to do something in the area where we have some control, choosing our friends.
So did your feelings about family give you any reservations about becoming a father yourself?
Well, no. In fact, quite the opposite. I tend to write about really dysfunctional families, but actually mine was pretty functional. I have to say, I'm kind of embarrassed to say that because writers are not supposed to have happy and conventional family lives. But my parents were happily married for as long as my mother was alive. And unfortunately for all of us, she died almost 20 years ago now. And my father, who I had not been so close to when my mother was alive, became kind of mother and father figure after my mother died. And so I actually had a wonderful example. We're a fairly close family, and we haven't had any of those terrible traumas. We haven't been riven by divorce. And if anything, I felt like maybe I ought to try and pass it along. So I was, I was lucky to have a pretty good model. And I was also lucky that my my children were born, one of them named after my father, about 9 months before my father died, so that he got to see them. It somehow seems very like a very good thing that I didn't wait any longer than I did.
I'm wondering what your father thought after you had reinvented yourself, when you became known as, the cool young writer who made the club scene back in the 80s. Did your father recognize that character?
No, he didn't really recognize that character at first. And also, on the one hand, he wanted to, he wanted me to reassure him that everything I was doing was fiction. And on the other hand, he would take issue with anything that he didn't think squared with his notion of my biography. He would complain when I said something about a father figure that he felt misrepresented him. I think it must have been tough for him. I had a very strange notoriety after the publication of my first book. And I'm not sure that many parents would have wanted to claim me as a son in my public incarnation any more than, I at one time wanted to claim them.
Yeah, my son is the novel who writes about the characters who go to clubs and do cocaine, right?
Yeah. But it's all fiction.
He doesn't know anything about it.
He just researched it at the library. Yeah. Now, it was very... I think it was tough for him, and it was tough, and he had to explain to the relatives that, the language was a little dicey and so on, but Jay didn't really mean it, so I thought for a long time that he really didn't approve of my career, and I caught him several times asking, wives and girlfriends of mine when I was actually going to settle down and get a real job. This at a time when it was clear that I was quite successful at what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And it upset me, I think, that I felt he didn't take what I was doing seriously. And then on the other hand, I discovered when he died last fall, I went through all of his effects, of course, and he had the most extraordinary collection of press clippings on me that I we'll ever see. I mean, he had virtually everything from every city in the United States and Europe. And I mean, because my father, for most of his life, was in charge of a sales force of some 60, 70 people. So he had salesmen all over the country and really all over the world, and they'd all send him this stuff. And he would very carefully file it and annotate it, save it. He had all the books and all the editions. And I was, you know, naturally very touched when I discovered this, because I just assumed somehow that he really didn't approve. And I, you know, I can't say that I blame him. So it was nice to know that he was really keeping track and that he was apparently appreciative.
My guest is Jay McInerney. His latest novel is called The Last of the Savages. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with novelist Jay McInerney. I want to ask you something else about your novel, The Last of the Savages. Uh-huh. Part of the book is about the narrator's experiences when he goes south to visit with his friend Will, and Will's from an old southern family, used to be slave owners. So Patrick has to get an understanding of the South, the wealthy white people in the South, that sense of family lineage that those wealthy white families have. And this part of the novel is set in Memphis in the Mississippi Delta. I know you live part of the time in Tennessee. What's it been like for you to live part of the time in the South after many years in Manhattan? And, you know, what did you draw on from your own experiences for that part of the book?
Well, this book certainly wouldn't exist if I hadn't been spending some part of the last 4 years in the South, in my case, outside of Nashville, Tennessee, which is quite a different city than Memphis. On the other hand, all my life I've been, or not all my life, but for a lot of my life I've been interested in the blues and in rhythm and blues and in the music that comes out of the Mississippi Delta and Memphis. I used to make pilgrimages down there when I was in college, later in life, to sort of search for the music, to find the music. It seems to me that the blues really is the great American folk art form of the 20th century. And so it's interesting for me when I moved down there. I'd also been a Civil War buff when I was a kid. And so moving to the South was kind of fascinating to me. I married someone from an old Southern family. Mm-hmm. And I'd always had an interest in the literature of the South, the music, the history. I also couldn't help getting more historically self-conscious when I started spending time in the South. When people in the South, in our part of the South, talk about the war, I mean, they don't mean, you know, Vietnam or World War II. They mean the one that ended in 1865. And you know, I live in a house that was built before the Civil War and that sits on the edge of a battlefield. You know, I sometimes dig up, you know, belt buckles and bullets. All of this kind of extended my time horizon, I guess. Suddenly I was living in a place where there was a real sense of continuity, of history, of tradition. You know, families going back three generations were in a place like Nashville are considered real new arrivistas. And I think all of this was reflected in the book, which really starts in 1965, but it really does look back to the Civil War. Will's kind of obsessed with his family's slave-owning past. And
have you met people like that in the South who are obsessed with it?
I have, yeah. Yeah, I have. Not, I mean, Will is a little unusual in being, I mean, he's a real maverick figure who feels like it's his personal job to atone for all of that history, and who feels that, you know, who feels closer really to the black people around him than to the white people. The book is also partly about race, and that's something that you think much more about in the South. And I have to say that the races exist in much closer proximity in the South. Things are closer to the surface there as well. And it's fascinating as a, you know, as a Yankee, which I certainly am, as a New Yorker, to be thrust into this very different environment. And I guess that a lot of the book really arose from that collision of cultures for me.
Now, you're the father of twins now. Your twins will have a...
be able to read my books.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Well, they're going to have a genetic connection to a part of history that's really foreign to you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That Southern lineage, that Southern white, wealthy, politically connected lineage. Is that going to be strange for you to know that they're connected by blood to something that you feel a real stranger to?
No, actually, I'm glad for them to have kind of roots that I didn't have. My father was very peripatetic in his career. He was always getting transferred, changing jobs. But I'm grateful that my kids will have those kind of roots if they want them. You know, that they can at least spend part of their life in a place where their ancestors go back 200 years, where the streets are named after their great-grandfathers and great-grandmothers. You know, I kind of envy that. I wish that I really came from someplace, but I don't feel that I do. I'm kind of a rootless American.
Jay McInerney, we're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jay McInerney's latest novel is called The Last of the Savages. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're going here by Sister Rosetta Thorpe. Here's the record that Jerry Lee Lewis is going to record. And, man, we've been playing it the last few nights, last four or five nights, and we've been having a lot of requests for it. And old Joe DeCougie had to order. He ordered 50 more here today. Here it is, Strange Things Happening Every Day by Sister Rosetta Thorpe.
Coming up, the story of Dewey Phillips, the first DJ in Memphis to play records by black and white performers, and the first DJ to play Elvis Presley.
Church people say they are in this holy way. There are strange things happening every day. On that last great judgment day, when they drive them all away, there are strange things happening every day. Every day.
Every day.
every day.
Every day.
There are strange things happening every day.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day.
Every day. There are strange things happening every day. If you want to view the crime, you must learn to quit your dime.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Memphis DJ Dewey Phillips is in the pop history books as the first DJ to play Elvis Presley. But to white people who grew up in Memphis in the 50s and 60s, he's perhaps even more important for introducing them to black music. He was the first Memphis DJ to play records by both white and black performers. The records he played changed the lives of many of his listeners, shaping the sensibilities of young musicians who helped create what became known as the Memphis Sound. Recently, excerpts of several of his shows were collected on a CD called Red, Hot, and Blue, which was also the name of his radio show.
Oh, yes, sir, good feeling, so Phillips. Everybody want to buy a duck? Got Kennedy Veterans Hospital, War 24E. Just flat fix and bring you the hottest thing in the country, Red, Hot, and Blue, coming to you through WHBQ in Memphis, Tennessee, and it's Friday night, tomorrow's payday and bath day. That's a good deal. Yes, sir, the first 15 minutes of Red, Hot, and Blue is coming to you through the courtesy of the best beer that money can buy. We're talking about CV for me and CV for you. That champagne velvet distributed by the Masquerade Company right here in the city of Memphis. Now, don't forget, Vinette, let's just flat wake up out there. Let's get ready. We're going to start off the first record here. Let's see now. Wait a minute here. We're going to play the first record for, let's see, for Demi, for Perry, for JV, for Bernice, for Vera, and for Beulah, for Effie, for Oliver, for Salome. We're going to play it for Bulldog. And the title is We're Going to Flat Dig the Boogie by Piano Red. Let's go, man. Oh, just set on it, boy. If you can't set on it, lay on it. Oh, anybody want to buy me?
My guest Jim Dickinson is one of the people whose life was changed by the music Dewey Phillips played. Dickinson is a mainstay of the Memphis music scene as a musician and record producer. He even had a cameo in Jay McInerney's novel, The Last of the Savages. He co-founded Mudboy and the Neutrons and produced records by Big Star, The Replacements, and Ry Cooder, and played on sessions with the Rolling Stones and Aretha Franklin. What was the mix of records you remember him playing?
Dewey'd play anything. He played anything he liked, and he liked good music, you know. He also played records that nobody else played. I thought that everyone was hearing the same music that I was hearing, if you know what I mean, until I went to college in Texas, and I realized that I had heard all this stuff that nobody else had ever heard. Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Strange Things Happening Every Day, Tell Me Why You Like Roosevelt by Otis Williams and the Charms. I mean, those were records that Dewey played daily, sometimes two or three times. He would play records over and over. The first night that Little Richard's, the follow-up to Tutti Frutti, which was Long Tall Sally, the first night that it came out, Dewey played it 14 times.
In a row?
In a row. And everybody wanted to hear it. I mean, it was that exciting a thing.
Now, Memphis was racially segregated at the
very
time.
Very much so.
But his show was musically integrated. Did anybody give him any heat for that?
Oh, sure. Before he ever went on the radio, just like Sam Phillips, he took heat for his personal taste. And there was an interesting thing about that. The world views Elvis Presley as if he was the innovator of that lifestyle. And this is not realistic, because Elvis represented a lifestyle that already existed in Memphis in 1951 or 52. The way he looked, the way he dressed, the way he acted. There weren't a lot of people who looked and dressed and acted that way, but there were some others. It wasn't just Elvis. My father used to say to me, well, why do you want a truck driver's haircut? Because that's what Elvis had. He was, you know, he looked like a truck driver. That's what he was. And the mindset, the interracial mindset that Dewey Phillips had was already alive. But I think what Dewey did is he fostered it in this community in a way that is unique. And I think Dewey created a mindset in the Memphis community that's still here today that is unique. Just because of the two or three generations of young people, both white and black, that listened to this crazy guy on the radio.
Tell me what impact it had on you to hear black music and how old you were when you were exposed to it for the first time.
Well, the first...
And again, we're talking about a racially segregated period in a racially segregated right. part of the United States.
Well, I was born in Little Rock, Arkansas, but I lived in Chicago until I was 9 years old, which I guess did give me a slightly different racial viewpoint. And we moved here in 49, which was the same time Dewey went on the air, and the same time Sam Phillips started recording. Actually, the world was about to change in Memphis in 1950, and you could almost feel it, you know. Certainly looking back at it, I can see it ready to change. And the impact that the first place I heard black music was I heard the Memphis Jug Band in an alley in downtown Memphis, and when I was about 9 or 10, and from that time on, I was really interested in very few other things, you know. And it was just a process of how do you find this music, even though it's just it was everywhere. It was around me everywhere, but it was at the same time inaccessible, racially inaccessible. And through the radio, with WDIA first and then with Dewey, this black music was accessible, you know, to a generation of white kids in East Memphis. And that generation included Charlie Freeman, Duck Dunn, Steve Cropper, the musicians who later in the late 60s and early 70s created soul music, white musicians.
So you were hearing a mix of black and white recording artists on the air. When you started playing music, did you play with a mix of black and white musicians?
No, that's real interesting. No, not until it was very difficult to play mixed in the late 50s. I started playing, I guess, in 58 as a semi-pro. And we played a few gigs with a vocal group called the Mad Lads. And at the time when we did it, it was illegal, and we were all underage, and, you know, it was very difficult to do. The first really mixed, racially mixed playing that I ever did was in Marquee Jobs. It was a band here on the early Stax label called the Marquees. It was a white band, and some of the musicians that recorded on the record were black, but the touring band was white. And when the band broke up in, I guess, 62 or 3, as bands will do, it splintered, and various groups would go on the road as the Marquees, and those groups would be mixed. And that was really, I would say, the first mixed playing in this area.
And
a direct result of Dewey Phillips. Everybody who was in that band because of Dewey Phillips.
How do you know that?
I knew them all. That's where there was only two places in Memphis that you could really draw from black music openly as a white teenager. One was through Dewey Phillips or the radio in general, and the second was a club called the Plantation Inn in West Memphis, where there was a band, Ben Branch and the Largos, who Ben Branch, of course, left music and went into politics and was standing next to Martin Luther King when he was assassinated. And that band is the band everybody copied.
All the kids in Memphis?
Yeah. If you want to put a box around what they used to call the Memphis sound, that was it. It was Ben Branch and the Largos.
One of the things Dewey Phillips is most famous for is being the first disc jockey in America to play Elvis Presley on the air. He played his record, That's All Right. And the way he got to be the first, he was good friends. Dewey Phillips was good friends with Sam Phillips, no relation. Sam Phillips, who owned Sun Records, which first recorded Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins.
And Howlin' Wolf.
Right, right.
I've heard Sam Phillips say himself that he considers his discovery of Howlin' Wolf more significant than his discovery of Elvis. So you can't ignore Howlin' Wolf.
Were you listening that very first time that Dewey Phillips played Elvis on the air?
No, I wish I could say I was, but no, I wasn't. And but the story about that I think is significant is that the way mythology depicts it, Dewey didn't know who Elvis was, when in fact he did know who Elvis was when he played the first record, because Elvis had played these sock hop dance parties that Dewey had used to do at the Chiska Hotel.
And the story goes that Dewey Phillips played the record over and over and over again because the phone started ringing,
right,
and telegrams were coming in. You know, who is this? We like it. Do you know people who remember hearing that? Is that something people actually talk about in Memphis?
And you know, I've never actually heard anybody claim to have heard the first broadcast. That's funny, because you would think that somebody would claim to, whether they did or not.
Exactly. Elvis Presley and Dewey Phillips became, I think, pretty good friends for a while. But they both ended up having problems with drug addictions for different reasons. Dewey Phillips was in a couple of car accidents, I think, and he ended up taking a lot of pain medication.
Well, Dewey would tell you that he had a war injury, which I'm pretty sure he didn't have. But he'd had a lot of car wrecks, and of course he broadcast it from the Veterans Hospital for a while. And he did, he was heavily involved with pain medication, especially later in life. And I think, you know, you can hear it in some of the broadcasts. Nobody knew what it was then, but, you know, that's what it was. Elvis, again, you have to consider about Elvis that when Elvis, as a 21-year-old kid, was making these records, he had been listening to Dewey on the radio, too, if you see what I mean. I mean, Dewey had helped create Elvis's mindset, the idea of doing the black music. I don't think Elvis thought of it.
My guest is Jim Dickinson. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the late Memphis DJ Dewey Phillips with Memphis-based musician Jim Dickinson. And Dewey Phillips, in addition to doing his radio show Red Hot and Blue, had a TV and radio show. It was simulcast.
Unbelievable television show.
It was called The Pop Shop.
Right.
Let me play an excerpt of The Pop Shop.
And at 3:30 on WHBQ Radio and WHBQ Television Channel 13, a simulcast. Everything breaks loose with the top-rated personality, Dewey Phillips, and his Pop Shop.
Oh, yes, sir, that's Octopus, Opus number one, right there, the late, great Tommy Dorsey. Yes, sir, good people, it's old Pop Shop. Don't forget, buddy, yes, sir, we got one of the hottest cotton-picking shows in the country. It's called Pop Shop. Yes, sir, we own television and radio at the same time, from 3:30 to 4:30 every afternoon. Yes, sir, and we average about 88 telegrams a day. That's getting them, ain't it, dears? Whoop, you're messing up, partner. That's right. Is that right, dears? That's right, partner. You call Sam? No, I got to call Sam in a minute, dear. Oh, hanging long, hey?
I'm all right. I'm all right.
That'll be it. Everybody's all right. Well, I'm having a big snow down in Miami today. Cold front hitting everywhere but Memphis. Yes, sir, good people. Pop Shop coming through WHBQ Television and WHBQ. Day gone, man, there's a flock of them flew over there. Bunch of cotton-picking snowbirds flying over here today. Yes, sir, let's all stay tuned.
Describe what it was like to listen to or to watch The Pop Shop, Jim.
Well, the TV show was amazing because this was at a time when no one had played music on television, recorded music on television. If you think about it, it was a pretty boring, prospect. And they set up a control room, and that's what Dewey did. He just sat there and played records. And people sent him stuff in the mail, and he would kind of gradually, he made the control room into an object of art just by sticking this stuff all over the walls. See, originally he was on in the afternoon, and Dewey's show was so powerful that he kept Dick Clark and the American Bandstand off of the local television for a year and a half. And finally, you know, the pressure came down, and he was moved to nighttime, and in the nighttime slot is where he got in trouble. He would cut into the network broadcast. If there was somebody on Dick Clark's show that he thought was pertinent to Memphis, like Jerry Lee Lewis or the Marquis, he just cut into the network feed and show it. He literally did whatever he wanted.
Why don't we hear some more of what Dewey Phillips sounded like on the radio? I think this might give a sense of him. He's talking a little bit about an Elvis photograph. He's doing a commercial, introducing a song, and just really talking quickly, I might add.
Main, right now, the whole next portion of Red Hot Blues coming through the curse of People's Furniture Company down at 310 South Main. We always welcome to buy, yes, sir, nothing but the best. This lady down there we call Grandma's been driving me crazy. I said I wish you'd get a picture of Elvis and get his autograph on it. Man, I got her one. I got a picture of Elvis's autograph. I'm telling you, man, she's run up down Main Street showing it to everybody. She's all right. Yeah, she's a nice lady. You better believe it. You go on down and see Grandma. Tell you don't see that picture of Elvis. She got mine down there too, partner. Yeah, but they got that down in the basement, dears. That's good old 310 South Main at People's Furniture Company, where you can buy good used furniture, brand new furniture, any kind of furniture you want to buy on the easy, easy credit terms. No can charges, no interest at all. Just pay a little bit down and pay for it while you're wearing it out, like me, or when they catch up with you. It's more like it. All right? It's okay. Nervous? Nope. All right. Well, come on here by Sister Rosetta Thorpe. Here's the record that Jerry Lee Lewis is going to record. And, man, we've been playing the last few nights, last 4 or 5 nights, and we've been having a lot of requests for it. No, Joe DeCuglia had to order. He ordered 50 more here today. Here it is, Strange Things Happening Every Day by Sister Rosetta Thorpe.
No one did improvised commercials before Dewey Phillips.
Is that right?
Oh, sure. Everything was scripted, you know, and the client was in control, had complete approval, but Dewey was so powerful that they stood in line, you know, trying to get him to do their commercials. And of course, he would insult the client, do whatever he wanted to. The Andy Griffith movie Facing the Crowd, I think it, of course, part of it was shot in Memphis. I think a lot of it was copied from Dewey.
Oh, yeah, he's like this real, like, populist...
Right, Lonesome Rhodes. Yeah,
yeah. A populist storyteller and personality on the air who becomes really corrupt.
Right.
Did Dewey Phillips become that corrupt?
No, what happened to Dewey is even sadder. He got a little power mad in Memphis, and he decided he could do it somewhere else. So he left Memphis, and he went to Little Rock, and he fell on his face. They just didn't understand what he was doing because it had been such a slow burn in Memphis. It had gradually happened, you know. It did, and he hit Little Rock full bore, wide open, and they didn't know what to do. He talked through the records, you know. He scratched the needle. He did stuff they weren't used to hearing, and he just didn't come across in Little Rock. And when he came back to Memphis, he went to a much smaller station, and it was just all over. And I really do think it started with the degeneration of his relationship with Elvis.
Dewey Phillips, after, you know, playing Elvis's record for the first time, became pretty good friends with Elvis Presley. But they had a big split up a few years after. What was that about?
Well, you go back to the beginning of the relationship. Dewey was the star and Elvis was the wannabe, you know, and of course that changed right away. And especially in Hollywood, I think Dewey became an embarrassment to Elvis when Elvis was around celebrities and whatever. Dewey never stopped being Dewey, and, you know, I think that embarrassed Elvis. So the split-up was probably coming, but what had actually came over was an incident where Dewey had been to Graceland and stole in advance acetate in one of Elvis's songs and started playing it on the air. And they told him to stop, and he wouldn't.
This is before the record was released.
Right, 6 or 7 weeks. In fact, they had to release the record early because of what Dewey was doing. And, you know, record companies get real upset about that kind of thing. And I think Dewey basically saw the record companies and the broadcast industry in general as the enemy, you know, and the listeners as the allies, if you see what I'm point.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think that was so appealing about Dewey was the element of danger, because the element of danger is real important to rock music in the early years, especially. And it gets harder and harder to capture that danger, you know, for the medium. And Dewey was definitely dangerous.
How well did you know Dewey Phillips?
Unfortunately, I knew him better in the latter days. I was too young, you know, when he was really hot and when he was at his peak. I worked at a recording studio, Ardent Recording Studio, which was out in North Memphis at the time, on his way to Millington from where he lived. He basically lived in the same neighborhood I did, the Berclair neighborhood out on Summer Avenue in East Memphis. In order to get to the Millington station, he would come by Ardent Studios, and he got to where he would stop in, you know, and talk. And of course, everybody there, you know, knew him and loved him and had grown up with him, you know, and on him, literally. And that's when I actually spent more time around Dewey. And, you know, it was sad time, but it, you know, it was valuable to me.
What was Dewey Phillips like at the end of his life when you knew him? He died at the age of 42.
Yeah. He never changed. He slowed down. You know, his speech pattern deteriorated, but he never changed. He was always Daddy O'Dewey, and he was always talking to Elvis, you know. I mean, he reached the point where he was, standing in traffic and, playing baseball with the cars and that kind of stuff. It was, and it was pretty bad. But he never stopped being Daddy O'Dooey. He worked in character, you know, and he could flip that switch and turn into Daddy O'Dooey.
What do you mean when you say he was always talking to Elvis?
Well, he called people Elvis, you know, and he, you know, he would pick up the telephone when there was nobody there and talk to Elvis and things like that.
You loved Dewey Phillips' craziness on the air. What was it like for you to deal with that craziness in person? Because Dewey Phillips sounds like he really was an out-of-control personality, at least toward the end of his life.
Yeah. Well, it deteriorated. I mean, you know, being around Dewey was a lot of fun, you know, for a long time. And I think everybody who knew him felt an obligation because of those good times and the fun, you know, to tolerate the rest of it, which towards the end of his life you had to do, you know. And he hitchhiked around town a lot, and you would, you know, pick up Dewey hitchhiking, and you would always end up taking him to a drugstore
to fill a prescription for.
Yeah,
he became addicted to pain pills after.
Yeah, right? And he'd go to Poplar Tunes, the record store where he used to broadcast. And he would go to the back, the distribution part of it, and pick up demo records. And, of course, he was virtually stealing them. But all the people who worked there had been told not to stop Dewey, you know, let him do what he wanted. And he'd walk in and pick up a bunch of records. And then he'd have, of course, when you pick him up hitchhiking, he'd say, "Oh, man, my leg is killing me. You got to take me to the doctor. Got to take me to Kennedy. I'm going to have it cut off." And then he'd say, "Well, you got to stop at Poplar Tunes first." So, and everybody knew what was going on. He'd get some records, and then he'd go out to Macon Pharmacy or some drugstore, and he'd swap the records for pills.
Hmm. You know, a lot of people who grew up in the 50s...
He would come to your house. Probably shouldn't say this, but Dewey would come to your house and go into the bathroom and take one of everything in the medicine cabinet. He didn't care what it was. Vitamins, laxatives. It was all doing something, you know.
Gee, I can only think of what it was like right after that.
Yeah.
were you afraid to have him come over to your house?
No. It was like a visitation from a holy man, as far as I'm concerned. I'd love to see him today.
Jim Dickinson is a Memphis-based musician and record producer. The Dewey Phillips CD, Red Hot and Blue, is on the label Memphis Archive. Coming up, a review of the new Sheryl Crow CD. This is Fresh Air. Sheryl Crow's debut album, Tuesday Night Music Club, was released in 1993, but took more than a year to become a hit. When she finally broke through with the single All I Want to Do, the album went on to sell more than 6 million copies. Rock critic Ken Tucker says her new album, called Sheryl Crow, is a more immediate crowd pleaser.
I used to ride with a vending machine repairman. He said he's been down this road more than twice. I've never been there, but the brochure looks nice. Jump in, let's go. Lay back, enjoy the show. Everybody gets high, everybody gets low. These are the days when anything goes. Every day is a winding road.
On her first album, Sheryl Crow presented herself as a smiley, good time gal. A woman who liked to hang out with the boys. The song she wrote didn't suggest that she was tough so much as she was flexible, as open to collaborating on a song as she was to sharing a six-pack. On her new release, all that has changed. It's no wonder she calls the record Sheryl Crow, since she's now an entirely different woman, someone whose sudden fame has come as a shock, left her exhausted and wary. Most rock musicians would set this experience to morose, downbeat melodies, but I think the key to this album's excellence is Crow's shrewd decision to go against the grain, to make her new misery sound irresistibly catchy, a virus you'd like to contract.
10 years living in a paper bag. His feedback baby is a flipped out cat. His platinum canary drinking Falstaff beer. Mercedes rule and a rented Lear. Bottom feeder, insincere. Prophet, lo-fi pioneer. Sellouts and go to school. Get a young girlfriend, daddy's too.
As that cut suggests, Crow has a canny way of invoking baby boomer rock, in this case a Beatles-y melody and echo effect, while giving it her own wrenching twist. She ain't no slacker, she wants to sell millions, but she also wants to do it on her own terms, with as much as what passes in the music industry for dignity. On the album's first single, the oh-so-ironically titled If It Makes You Happy, Crow steals a guitar riff from the Rolling Stones to give her music a little snake bite. If you listen to the words, you can hear Crow trying to distance herself from all the other angry young women on the charts these days.
I've been long, long way from here. Put on a poncho, played for mosquitoes, and drank till I was thirsty again. We were searching.
Many of the lyrics on this album consist of self-consciously clever wordplay and puns. I hear them as a kind of code, a way for Crow to signal that what she'd really like to be doing is complaining. In the current rock climate, just because she's a woman who sold millions of records her first time out, she's already looked upon as a sellout by the alternative rock crowd that initially championed her. Crow is smart enough to know that this sort of thing would strike most people as whining, so instead she's letting us know that her skin has gotten thicker, and that she's here to stay, at least for a while. To me, this has resulted in the best mainstream rock album I've heard all year.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Naomi Person, with Barbara Bogave and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
She comes, she's all dressed up in day. You'd swear that she is crazy. Flowered drinks, low-cut dress. That's the way I know her best. She says she's lonely. How could she?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Bill Moyers talks about the impact of Bible stories on his life. His new PBS series and companion book bring together theologians, novelists, and artists to discuss their interpretations of the book of Genesis. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.